Hello, I'm Manila Chan. You are tuned in to Modus Operandi. He is often called the most powerful man on the planet. It's not Joe Biden. It's not Xi Jinping. It's not Vladimir Putin either. In fact, he's not an elected leader at all. Today, we're talking about Klaus Schwab, whose reach from the World Economic Forum has no borders. Just who is this man, and why do elected leaders listen to him? All right, let's get into the MO. The year was 1938. Germany saw the rise of fascist dictator Adolf Hitler. Klaus Schwab was born into a Nazi Germany on the 30th of March that year. Now, later that fall, Kristallnacht, the night that saw thousands of Jewish people rounded up by the Nazis, a pogrom that would start what the world now knows as the Holocaust. Now, this is not to say that Schwab had any ties to the Nazis, but a young Klaus certainly spent his early years under a fascist ruler who had dreams of a one-world order led by Nazis. Now, psychologists today regularly say that these early childhood experiences shape the adults that we become, not to mention our parents' and caregivers' experiences. So if that theory holds true, the World Economic Forum founders' advocacy for a globalized government is pretty easy to explain. But not much else is known about Klaus Martin Schwab. He was born in 1938. He grew up, went to university, became a businessman, an economist, and also a professor. Then out of nowhere, at age 33, in 1971, became the founder of the World Economic Forum. So from birth to 33, nobody really knows. Well, he did eventually marry a woman called Hilda, who he met just before the launch of WEF, and married her in 1972. So she's approximately 10 years his junior. Klaus and Hilda have two children, Nicole and Olivier. They all serve in chair positions at WEF. But this is about as much as the media knows about Klaus. It seems his childhood is a mystery. Who was his best friend as a boy? Did he have any girlfriends? Did he play any sports? Nobody knows. It was as if one day he was born and suddenly he was an adult and founded the WEF. It seems Klaus's personal history only begins there in 1971. To talk more about Schwab and the WEF, we're being joined by economist and an author of several books. His latest book is called The Evil Twins of Technocracy and Transhumanism. That book is out now. Patrick Wood, the editor-in-chief at technocracy.news, is here with us. Pat, thanks for being with us. First, can you clue us into Klaus Schwab's early life? Why in this day and age is there such scant information about his background? I mean, for a man as famous and powerful as he, how can there be such a gap in his public history?
Part of the reason is because Klaus Schwab got involved with a group of people that were at the time moving towards the creation of a very important international group called the Trilateral Commission. It was founded in 1973 by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski. At the time, a few years earlier, Schwab was at Harvard University. And it was at Harvard that Schwab met Henry Kissinger. And Kissinger, being a little bit older than Schwab, was became a mentor to him. He was an engineering student, actually already had his engineering doctorate, but he was an engineer. He was also interested in political science and economics. Kissinger took a liking to him, and not just because they both had accents, I'm sure, but he took a liking to him. And Kissinger's role at the time, he was very much known as a Rockefeller man at that point. He was working for Richard Nixon, of course, but both Nixon and Kissinger were considered to be Rockefeller people, agents of the Rockefeller dynasty, if you will. And Their goal was to expand beyond the United States into other parts of the world. And that's what the Trilateral Commission became. They went into Japan and Europe and North America to try and influence economic policy around the world. They call it the New International Economic Order back in those days. And Schwab, being from Europe, and from Germany at that point, but he was actually born and raised in Switzerland, but he was German at that point. Kissinger recognized that Schwab was a very highly intellectual person and that he had aspirations to make a splash in Europe of the same type that the Trilateral Commission was going to make in the United States and, again, around the world. So he encouraged Schwab to go back and start the early iteration of the World Economic Forum. It wasn't known by that name originally. They changed its name soon thereafter. It was formed. And the purpose of the World Economic Forum back then was to bring about more or less a discussion group amongst some leadership of the region in Europe to discuss policies related to globalization. And initially, it was pretty much a meager effort, but then so was the Trilateral Commission as well. It was a relatively small organization, just 170, 80 people at the time in 1973. And in any case, the role that Schwab played early on was to create a beachhead for globalization, for this new type of globalization in Europe. Kissinger was about to enter into the first membership role of the Trilateral Commission in 1973. That was just a couple years later. And so over the years, both organizations have grown. And I'd have to say that Klaus Schwab is not the independent instigator of the World Economic Forum at all. He was very much tied into the original crowd of that focused and kind of rotated around the Rockefeller world. And he went on, obviously, become very successful in his efforts. And so did the Trilateral Commission. That's a long story. We may not have time to get into it right now. But anyway, that was kind of the early genesis of this. And Schwab has maintained connection with Kissinger and a couple of his other mentors that he met at Harvard. In fact, I can picture a conference that Schwab participated in maybe two or three years ago, where somebody asked him, who were the most important people in your life back then? And Henry Kissinger was, I think he said there's three people. Henry Kissinger was one of those three. So even to this day, there's this relationship here between that part of the quote unquote global elite and Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum. Hopefully that kind of covers the question.
Now let's jump to today. The WEF is attended by the who's who of the global elites. There's, you know, industry CEOs, presidents, prime ministers, and so forth. Why and how did Schwab manage to make global elites desire to take part in this, I guess we can call it a social club? Why did they take part in the first place? Explain for us, if you can, how the WEF became a thing.
The World Economic Forum is, on one hand, a discussion group. They're not like the United Nations exactly, where they make policy that can be enforced in various countries. However, starting back in the early 1970s again, the Trilateral Commission set about to create a new international economic order. That's what they called it. I now know that to be technocracy. That was not known at the time, but at least to us, but that turns out that's what it was, a new international economic system. And so as that new international economic order grew, of course, all the businesses of the world are involved in that. They have to be. The international corporations, the global corporations that have no roots in any particular nation, or at least no loyalty to a particular nation. Maybe like we have some companies in America, for instance, that are not loyal to America whatsoever. They might as well just be in China or, you know, Uganda. It doesn't make any difference where they are. They operate globally. But when you shake the money tree in the world, people line up to get their share. That's maybe kind of too simplistic, but when you're shaking up the international order and creating a new flow of money, a new flow of business activity, all the people that are playing in that space want to be intimately involved. And this is what's happened at the World Economic Forum. The World Economic Forum brings all these business leaders together, along with government officials, along with banking officials, the heads of central banks and so on. I mean, it's a place to go. If you want to network and get in the flow of things, that is where you're going to go.
Now, conversely, why is Klaus Schwab invited to events such as the latest G20 in Bali? I mean, that event, for example, is supposed to be for elected leaders, heads of states, foreign ministers, and so forth. Why does he get invited to these big official events?
It's a good question, too. The World Economic Forum is not a nation state, obviously. However, the WEF has been recognized by many nations, well, including the United Nations, but also Switzerland and Germany and a bunch of other European nations. They have been recognized as a global institution. And this is kind of along the lines of Schwab's stakeholder capitalism idea. In fact, he's been pushing the stakeholder capitalism stuff since he first started in 1971. The stakeholder concept means that outside parties can be involved with whatever it is that's going on in a given country. And Schwab is very open about the stakeholder capitalism thing. He says, well, you know, the environmental groups are stakeholders. They should be involved in meetings and stuff. And, of course, the corporations are stakeholders. And the government people, government leaders are stakeholders. And there could be, you know, other entities around the world that might be stakeholders. But in the frame of being a stakeholder, Klaus Schwab views the World Economic Forum as being the most important stakeholder, non-governmental stakeholder in the world. And they've been declared to be an international organization, officially an international organization. They have the highest rating, for instance, with the United Nations. And so it's no surprise that he would get invited to, and even if he didn't, he would just show up and who's going to tell him to go away?
Wow. Okay. Let's take a moment to digest all of this. So coming up next, French President Emmanuel Macron and his ties to Mr. Schwab. Patrick Wood will be back to discuss it. The MO will be right back.
Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. Wherever people long to be free, they will find a friend in the United States.
We came here peacefully. We are asking our minimum basic rights in this country as a human being.
Dietro la Primavera araba e le varie rivolte nei vari paesi si sono inseriti i giochi delle grandi potenze, dei servizi segreti.
Color revolutions is one among several means to reach the goal of conquering foreign lands and bringing them under the helm of US Western economic interests.
Si può pensare ad un'architettura globale di democrazia.
Le rivoluzioni colorate sono un tassello del soft power americano.
The final goal of these theme revolutions is to ensure that there are no independent players in the world anymore.
Welcome back to The MO. I'm Manila Chan. We're continuing to learn more about Klaus Schwab. Patrick Wood, thank you so much for sticking with us. So tell us more about the WEF. What is the nature or the point of these annual Davos summits? What do they discuss? And are these topics really consequential to us regular civilians?
Very much so. Schwab wrote a book recently called The Great Narrative. And one has to kind of get an idea of what narrative is all about. And I don't have time probably to explain it right this second, but whoever creates the narrative pretty much controls the downline of that narrative. And that's the most important thing that Schwab contributes to the whole WEF crowd. He creates the narrative. And so he wrote this book called The Great Narrative. And especially when COVID hit, he put out the propaganda line that this this represents a unique opportunity to call for a great reset, that this is necessary now with COVID has happened and the world is all upside down. And we need a great reset to reset the economic system altogether. Well, of course, that's what the global crowd has been calling for decades, but he made it sound like a brand new idea. And so he wrote he wrote a book called The Great Reset too, but then he wrote a book called The Great Narrative. And so when people meet in Davos, they hear elements of The Great Narrative. Now, the people that attend Davos were not the ones that created The Great Narrative that Schwab wrote about. I traced the history on this, by the way. All of the contributors were named in the front of the book. I went and did a research project on all of them to see where they're from, what kind of industry they were in, and blah, blah, blah. And I found out that the vast majority, like 80% of the contributions to The Great Narrative, came from academic institutions in the United States, not from Europe, not from any country in the South, not from South America, not from Africa. It came from academic organizations within the United States and very elite ones at that. So you have a foreign narrative that's been created on how the world is going to look in 10 to 15 years with steps on how to get there. And this is the narrative that is promoted at the World Economic Forum. There's never another alternative narrative. There's never any plan B whatsoever. It's always this one that's presented. So how would you expect, I suppose, any of those companies to act when they get drilled with this new great narrative? They're going to say, well, that sounds good to me. If that's where the money is, that's where I'm going to be. And that's what I want to do. And so they run off after the great narrative. I'm sure some of them don't even question it. They think, oh, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. And, you know, can't wait to do it. Can't wait to fulfill that. Others might be skeptical and they might say to themselves, I'm skeptical, but I want to get rich. So I'm going to follow the great narrative. Either way, whoever controls the narrative controls everything that's within that narrative, you know, as time moves forward. This is exactly what's happening here.
Now, talk to us a little bit about the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Program, the YGL. What is it? Who's graduated from that program? What do these people go on to do as alumni of this program?
Well, yes, the Young Leaders Program was a stroke of genius on Schwab's part, I'm sure, to bring young people to the table to indoctrinate them with the great narrative. That's essentially back to the great narrative again. This is where you get indoctrinated. Doesn't matter what your education or skill level is or what your skill set or what position you might hold in government. But the Young Leaders Program is basically, I hesitate to use the word brainwashing, sort of, but you know, they're talked about incessantly about what this future is going to be, that they've created. The young leaders are not invited to create the future. In other words, to have discussions about what the future should look like. No, that's left up to Klaus Schwab and his high-level cronies. But once they have determined, well, this is the way the world's going to go, then they're going to bring these young people in, and they're going to put them in at the table or on the table, whatever, to pound this into their head that this is where it's going, and you need to participate. You need to follow along with it and do the things that are appropriate that will get us down the road. So when they go back to society, whether they ever become something or not, some don't, by the way. There's been, I think, 3,000 or more than 3,000 graduates of the Young Leaders Program over time. Some of them amounted to absolutely nothing. They just went home and maybe they became, started a business or something. They never really got involved in global affairs. But others did. And for instance, half of the people, the top level people right now in the Canadian government, happen to be young, graduates of the Young Leaders Program. And it's not like a university exactly. It is not like becoming a Rhodes Scholar either, by the way. It's not that high level. And it's not really educative. It's more, conditioning of the people to think a certain way and, to realize that they need to play along with the game as they move forward. And there have been lots of people that have been surprising, that have been on the Young Leaders list. The list is public, by the way. I'm not really sure who got it, but I received a copy of it. There's about 31 or 32, maybe 3,200 people on the list. And I read through the whole list. I was compelled. It took me a while to get through it. It probably gave me a headache too. But I looked at the whole list, and there was a few names on it that pretty surprising. I don't have any in my mind right this second, but some people that you kind of wouldn't expect maybe would have done that, but they did. And they're all over the world. It's not just in one place. It's all over the world. Now, the Young Leaders Program, it's interesting to say here, this is a training school. This was important to somebody like Henry Kissinger way back when, and even over the decades, this has been an important issue. How do you train leaders to go into government to do the things that the Great Reset wants them to do that will facilitate this new international economic order? The United Nations has also picked up on this because they do a lot of training too, of course. They take people in and work them over really good somehow to get the UN ideas in their brain. But the World Economic Forum and the United Nations work hand in hand. They're very closely aligned, and it's all over the World Economic Forum's website as well as the United Nations website. They're virtually one and the same, like two peas in the same pod, as far as operational concerns go.
Is it fair to characterize Klaus Schwab as an unelected world leader?
As an unelected leader, no. Personally, I would not. He is an academic, however, like Henry Kissinger was an academic. And normally, the power structure is not run by academics. More often than not, it's run by the international banking community. That would be the central banks and certain, and probably some commercial banks as well. You got some really giant banks around the world, like the JP Morgan Chase, like Citigroup, like Wells Fargo, like Deutsche Bank, Bank of England, so on. But the power structure seems to be where the money flows. That was Rockefeller's role in 1973. He was the chairman at that time of Chase Manhattan Bank, which later became JP Morgan Chase. And Chase Manhattan was the third largest bank in the world. Well, it didn't mean exactly that David Rockefeller ran the world, because he didn't. He wasn't acting like a political leader. But it shows that the influence of the narrative, the influence of the other people that came in, who would be more interested in creating a new international economic order than a banker, a money person? That makes sense, because money is the blood of the economic system. So over the decades, we've seen this banking institution flux a little bit, where some banks would kind of maybe drop out, others would come in. But today, interestingly enough, the power structure in the Trilateral Commission especially has shifted from what we would view as commercial banks to central banks. And there's not very many central banks in the world. There's one for every country, but one central bank like our Federal Reserve does not serve other countries. It just serves us or our government. But every central bank in the world right now, for instance, is working on creating a central bank digital currency. Now, that'll put the economy on its head for sure. And you have at the top of that pyramid, if you will, the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. They are the ones that are, well, that's the central bank to central banks around the world. They pretty much set the policy and the tone for all the other central banks in the world. This more likely is where you see the power coming from. In other words, who orders the narrative? Where does the narrative, the research for the great narrative come from? If you look at Klaus Schwab's book called The Great Narrative, you'll see that, I don't know, 80% or 90% of the people that contributed to the book were academics. Well, academics don't act independently. They don't just one day stand up and say, I'm going to write a paper about the World Bank or something like that. No, that's not the way it works. They work for pay. They work for hire. And the money that flows to educational or academic institutions to create studies that support globalization, they're all funded by somebody. The question is who? Because the funders are the ones that pick the topics, if you understand what I'm saying. They could pick exactly what they want. Write a paper about this, justify this policy, whatever, with some type of, do some academic magic on it so it looks good to everyone that this is what we have to do. So the academic class, if you will, that section, that layer of globalization, the academic class actually doesn't have any power at all. Do they have influence? Yes. Is Klaus Schwab an influencer? Absolutely. But is he really a substantive controller? I dare say no, he's not.
Pat, this has been enlightening. It's unfortunate I have to leave it right there. I am out of time. Thank you so much. Patrick Wood is the editor at technocracy.news. And that is going to do it for this week's episode of Modus Operandi, the show that digs deep into foreign affairs. I'm your host, Manila Chan. Thank you for tuning in. We'll see you again next week to figure out the MO.